Hello, and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
Gabe, I believe you have emails from some of our many listeners around the world.
We got one from Canada, right off the bat here. Gabe and Connor.
The good email or the bad email?
This is the best email, one of the
Okay.
best ones we've gotten in a while. I heard you this week read an email from fellow Canadian Deanna about her getting up at 3 a.m. to listen to Science Unscripted. I work shift work in an underground nickel mine, and on my way home after night shift, I hear SU at 4:30 a.m. on my Saturday commute. My drive is about 40 minutes, and Science Unscripted on CBC Radio usually accompanies my journey for most of it. I have subscribed to your podcast so I don't miss an episode when my schedule doesn't give me my drive home, with your airing in the land of moose and maple syrup. Keep up the great work, and I look forward to the end of September when your excellent and informative show follows me home. Adam Cottery.
I just, it
Nick, a
is,
nickel mine? What's that like,
yeah.
Adam?
Adam, if you're listening to this one, feel free to send us an email. Yeah, that was my first thought. What is that like to be in a nickel mine? That's the one thought. The other thought is just how really, truly, deeply wonderful it is for Gabe and me to be able to imagine. And the image might be more beautiful than reality. Imagine someone driving home, it's the middle of the night, it's dark, and with these sounds coming out of the car's speakers, there is something special about listening to the radio in a car as opposed to with headphones on.
I always thought about that when Gus the Paperboy would write to us. The
Yeah.
idea of us accompanying him on his paper route, also in the middle of the night on Sunday mornings, also in Canada, it's just amazing.
Sounds are different when it's dark. That may be part of it. Sound has a stronger impact when there's less visual information coming at you.
And also, we hadn't heard from Adam ever. Imagine
Right.
how many other people there are in this world who listen to us. We had listeners from.
Oh, yeah. I should say hello, first of all, to all of our many new listeners, primarily out of India and Pakistan. We talked on one of our recent episodes about symbiosexuality. Symbiosexuality is a new definition for the sexual attraction a surprising amount of people do appear to feel for a couple.
That has already been established.
Yes, not
Two people,
in
you want both of them.
you want both of them, and the energy between them, their shared outlook on the world, the being with them is just special. You might not even be able to define why. I think that's probably more likely the case. And in the Harvard Pleasure Study, it was roughly 40% of people who said, yes, I felt something like that before. Symbiosexuality. And
And based on our analytics, we had a lot of people listening, new listeners from India who were interested in that particular piece.
India, Pakistan, Brazil. So to all of you who have just come across Science Unscripted for the very first time because of symbiosexuality,
Welcome.
welcome. Yeah, and if you have any thoughts on symbiosexuality, su at dw.com, that's how you can send them our way.
Yeah.
We'll repeat that again later, but hello and welcome to all of you.
We were just talking about Canada real quick. I made a geographical mistake, apparently,
A grave error.
last
A
week.
grave
I must have
error.
said that the capital of Manitoba was something else other than Winnipeg, or that Manitoba was in Saskatchewan. I didn't mean that. I know the difference between Saskatchewan and Manitoba. I'm just a little scatterbrained. I'm so sorry, Alan.
Oh, yeah, Alan. Yeah, Alan wrote into us
Thank you
about that.
for correcting that mistake. Sorry about that.
But
It'll never happen again.
how polite
The
of.
difference between Manitoba and Saskatchewan, never make that
I
mistake.
mean, you are good with stuff like that. You are,
Yeah.
yeah. And how polite of the rest of you not to write in and
Yeah.
call us out on that. That was also really nice.
Yeah.
Very, very polite of you. I have one, speaking of YouTube, a YouTube comment that I'm going to read out. It's more of an update on something we talked about before. Gabe, this will possibly ring a bell. Kachira. I don't know if that means anything to you. Kachira
We read
2012.
one of her comments
We
out
did.
before.
Yeah, she had a comment on one of our previous episodes.
On the Norwegian study, right? The double standard.
We read her comment out loud
Yeah.
in the same episode where we, speaking of sexuality, where we talked about double standards.
Being reversed up in Norway and
Yeah.
not in Germany, or
If someone has recently had more sexual partners, or a few sexual partners, then what people think society thinks is that the women would be judged more harshly for that, when in truth, what the Norwegian study appears to show is that at the individual level, if you ask me, how do I feel about that? Women are judged less harshly for it, and men are judged more harshly for that recent sexual activity. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a flip or a flop or whatever you want to call it. Anyway, we read her her YouTube comment out there.
Yeah.
And then I suggested, because of her name, because of her YouTube handle, that it ends with 2012, that she was probably a young listener, maybe born in 2012. That would make her what?
That's a fair enough.
That, I mean, 12.
That's a...
And do you remember what you said back to me?
No.
You said, well, maybe she just likes the year 2012.
Yeah.
Which I thought, I think I laughed at it because it's a ridiculous... I don't know how many people have a special year in mind. Well, yeah, I don't know. 2012 was kind of fun.
I mean, I really like 1995.
I do too, but she responded, she listened and responded, and she wrote, 2012 is not actually my birth year.
Yeah.
I'm 31.
Yeah.
So I wrote her back or on YouTube, Kachira, thanks for checking in, even if this means my assumption was wrong.
Yeah.
And I basically asked her, what was it then? What was 2012 about? And she wrote, I would say it was just a fun year where, where me being a teen... found news like the world is ending in 2012 to be so outlandish and funny. And it was basically, it confirmed what you said. It was a great year.
Yeah.
2012 was one of her favorite years. And then I wrote her back and
said. And you must have thought that me saying that was outlandish.
I thought that was outlandish. I thought that was ridiculous.
Well, maybe you're being outlandish from time to time.
I should trust you more.
Right.
I should trust you a lot more.
Science time. What do we do? I got names. What do you?
Well, you've got some fast twitch muscles, I believe.
Oh, that's a shout out to Kathy. Sorry. We got a question, a science question from one of our listeners. What is the difference between fast twitch and slow twitch muscles, and how do we know which type we have? Kathy, we have both types. Everyone has both types. Some people have more of one of the types depending on what activity they are really good at. Weightlifters, anyone who needs explosive power from their muscles probably has more fast twitch muscles. Endurance runners like Connor over here probably have more slow twitch muscles because there is a difference between the two. One of them is used for very quick, explosive outbursts of power that can't go on for a long time. The other ones can do the same thing for a long, long time. Slow twitch muscles. And that's pretty much the answer. I mean, there's nothing more to say about it.
I was going to say, it comes up a lot in sports. And now that you're saying this out loud, I've never heard anyone get examined for fast twitch versus slow twitch.
You could have each individual fiber of your muscles tested for it to see the percent, but I don't know what that would do for you because you would know based on what you are good at and what you can do, which ones you have.
Yeah. Right? And let's assume you've either won the genetic lottery or haven't, or you're like most people, you're somewhere in between. It's probably on a day-to-day basis, not as relevant as pursuing those exercise activities and trying to strengthen yourself in a way that makes sense for your life.
Kat, if you want to train one of them, there is one way to train them in your legs, plyometric exercises where you do a lot of jumping, box jumping, jumping from side to side. That's a way to train those muscles. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to do them in your arms, you could do push-ups where you, instead of just doing them normally and slow, you do them really fast and try and push yourself up. That would be one way to do it. But
I'm just kind of stuck on the idea or the question of whether how many adults need to be able to jump well.
I guess it depends on what you're doing.
How often does an adult jump on a day-to-day basis? Jump. Probably, you know what I mean? No, sorry.
Good question. Good question.
But just to get back to the idea of train what you need, mm-hmm. right? That's different than what other people need. And for me, I like going out and jogging. When I do that, I'm training for it, and that makes sense for my life. Whereas, you know, what something very, very different might be what you want to be good at. Is it flexibility? Is it bending over and getting under things or clambering over things? A lot of different things in there. Real quick, news. Some news, and I'm gonna start off with a little bit of audio here, and to kind of contextualize it, I'll take a tweet that was posted by astronaut Chris Hadfield, who was up on the International Space Station, a very charismatic guy, played music up there, very good with the media. He said, you know what, there are several noises that I would prefer not to hear inside my spaceship, right, if you're up in space, including this one, that Boeing Starliner, which was attached to the International Space Station, is now making.
Thank you.
I didn't know any better, I'd say that's aliens.
That, right? There's nothing worse that you could possibly hear when you're somewhat isolated in low Earth orbit. And it, how horrifying. You can, online, you can find the entire exchange between one of the astronauts. His name is Butch Wilmore. He basically got in contact with NASA and he's like, what is this? What's going on? And he found a way so that they could listen to it in real time. I think some people, ham operators, who listened to all that communication, recorded this and then posted the whole thing online. That's why it's a news story.
What is the sound?
According to NASA, this is what I suspected it was from the beginning. This got a lot of attention online because I'll get to in a sec. Boeing Starliner has had lots of issues.
Yeah.
This is a speaker feedback error. And so the Boeing Starliner is a separate capsule. It docked on to the International Space Station, and they have various cables and audio setups where one communicates with the other. Something got stuck on a feedback, on a loop. Anyone who's played around with speakers, sometimes if you get a microphone too close to a speaker, it can start looping in and on itself. They solved it. And again, by the time all of you are listening to this, it depends when you're listening to this, that Boeing capsule should already be back on the ground without the astronauts. That's the big news story.
Yeah.
This thing has been a disaster. They've been up there for 2 months now. They were only supposed to be up there for a week.
How long are they supposed, or are they going to be stuck up there, trapped?
According to SpaceX, which is launching the rocket and the Dragon capsule, which will go up there and pick them up and bring them back, that launch is going to happen in late September. And the return mission back down, bringing them back down to Earth, is going to be February. NASA's a little bit more vague. They're saying spring. That's the plan, but this is a kind of a black eye for Boeing and its Starliner mission that they are working on rectifying.
All right, thanks for that bit of news. A study on names. Unbelievable findings, I think, that your name probably changes the appearance of your face.
I've seen people with names tattooed on their faces, but I'm assuming that's not what this is about.
They did a bunch of experiments in Herzliya, Israel, in the first set of experiments, hundreds of people, and they showed them headshots of adults and headshots of kids, and asked them to guess the name of the adult face and guess the name of the child's face. Gave them four different options.
So I don't. Oh, that I was gonna say because there's so many names out there. But you can select between four.
Yeah, and the statistically it was significant. The people were able to guess the adult face, the name of the adult face, way better than they were the child's face.
Mm-hmm.
So you're given Scott, Connor, John, and Timothy.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, based on the adult face. More what the name of that face was compared to the kid.
Because of my name, I tend to dress and look differently. I grow into my name. I become that.
For whatever reason, it was easier for people to know that face is Connor.
Yeah, but the only way, not the only way, but one of the only ways is if you think that, or you become aware as an adult, right, that Gabriel has Gabriel has a certain feeling attached to it, and whether or not you know it, you begin adopting that persona.
Has a different hair, has a certain haircut, smiles more. The more you smile, the more your facial features change over time. They took it to the next level and used machine learning to compare all kinds of different faces with certain names to see if those were similar compared to other faces. So they looked at all the Connors in this set of 600 different faces and wanted to see similarities between all the Connors compared to all the other faces. And this is called a Siamese neural network. And again, statistically significant, there was a 60% similarity lift amongst all the faces
facial.
With a certain name compared to the other
names. But hold on a sec. My name is Connor because way back when, my Irish ancestors wandered over to the United States. And so there should be similarity between the Connors out there if there's a connection back to the source of that name. Do you know what I mean?
If that's the reason why people named their kid Connor, then yeah.
There's also, my name came partially from a book published back when I was born, Leon Uris, and one of the main characters was named Connor. So that would have, spread through society, but still probably more of the people who had a connection to Ireland or, yeah, I don't know, wanted to reference their Irish ancestry, in that case, would have latched onto that. But I guess what I'm trying to say with a lot of words, yeah, that makes more sense to me than people being able to guess someone's name unless it's also connected to that, unless there's some sort of genetic aspect to it. Like your middle name is Leif,
yeah,
right?
Leif. That one would make sense. But for the Bobs and the Tims and the Bonnies and the Catherines,
right,
then I'm not sure that that applies. The next thing they did, and I know that you have experience with this, they used software to artificially create adults out of children's faces.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right? Yeah, I've used those apps.
And then they asked 100 people to guess the names of those fake adults with the face created by the children's face,
mm-hmm,
and they weren't able to guess them compared to actual people.
Because the software is not good enough to replicate what actually happens to the human, how it changes
that
over time
is, in the end,
to
that's
reflect
the
name.
In
yeah,
the question, does your face change over time? If let's say my name's Gabriel. Do I don't know, comb my hair in a certain way because I'm Gabriel, because that's the way a Gabriel lives? Does my face learn how to look over time?
Or do you have like wings from your hair because the Archangel Gabriel also had wings?
I don't think...
Is that possible?
I don't think that's what's going on.
Could be. So am I understanding you? Open question. We don't know why this is the case, which is always interesting.
No idea.
What do you listeners think is happening here?
Yeah.
I can't figure it out. What is happening there?
It's statistically way too significant it's way more than random chance. Like these people were able to guess the names of faces more than they should have been.
Does your name, again, open question, does your name change the shape of your face or appearance, really, over time? Your facial appearance, the appearance of your whole head over time. And best of luck to the astronauts aboard the International Space Station for much longer than they expected.
February.
To Butch, to Suni, to U.S. astronauts up there. They're doing fine for now, expected to come back in February. And that's it for now. Yeah, keep sending your emails and leaving YouTube comments.
Yeah.
SU@DW.com.
That's the email address.
Yeah. Till next time. We are going to take a few minutes here to talk about a breakthrough with regard to a disorder in the human brain that makes it difficult, in the best case, impossible in the worst case, for hundreds of millions of people around the world to make sense of words that are written on paper.
Yeah. Dyslexia. The numbers vary when it comes to how many people suffer from this, up to 1 in 5. We're talking about the inability for the human brain, regardless of intelligence, to read.
Is not connected to intelligence. And going
not
back,
at all.
Going back to the discrepancies, some studies we've seen puts the number at 20%, 1 in 5 people. I'm going to reference here, for example, the European Dyslexia Association, and there they put the number at 3-4%. The truth is probably somewhere in between. And again, depends which severity you're talking about. But the fact is, hundreds of millions of people around the world, and it changes your life. It makes certain aspects that a lot of people take for granted very, very, very challenging. And I think most of us know people who have dyslexia.
There is no treatment at this point for dyslexia. Nothing you can do to the brain to fix this.
Well, and part of the reason for that is that you need to know where exactly in the brain you have to be looking and treating, right? Like that's the issue.
Researchers here in Germany have possibly found that.
Yeah.
Science Unscripted.
Hi, my name is Christa Müller-Axt, and I'm a researcher working in the field of neuroscience And together with my colleagues, I recently published a paper on developmental dyslexia in brain.
When I was in school, I had a friend named Dale, and Dale was a very smart kid, but he couldn't read. Mm-hmm. What is going on in Dale's brain?
That's a very good question, and the answer that we're actually seeking with our research. So developmental dyslexia is a very common learning disorder. Actually, it's the most common learning disorder affecting millions of children and adults worldwide. And these individuals typically severely struggle to acquire proficient reading levels and actually often continue to face these challenges throughout their lives. In our study, we focused on a very specific part of the brain called the visual thalamus. And what is important in the context of our study is that it consists of two main subdivisions that handle different types of visual information. So one part, which is only about the size of a peppercorn, is, for example, about detecting visual motion, while the other part focuses, for example, on color processing. So it's kind of like having two specialized teams in the brain working together to create the full picture of what we see.
And the more we know about why this happens, the more we'll be able to help the people who are suffering from it. Are we already there yet that we can use the breakthrough that you guys have made to help people?
I do think that our results could have significant implications for developing new therapeutic approaches. And that is because in our research, we show that the changes that we see in the brain, in the visual thalamus, in individuals with dyslexia, are directly related to reading performance, specifically in males with the disorder. So this could open up venues for example, non-invasive neurostimulation techniques as a promising therapeutic method to actually modulate the activity of these brain structures, thereby alleviating some dyslexia symptoms. And as I said, especially, for example, in male individuals with the disorder.
And if you were to do this to my old friend Dale's brain, would he then magically be able to read, or would he need a number of these therapies over a long period of time before he can then develop the skills necessary for reading, or what?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So far in the context of dyslexia, it has been shown that word reading speed can actually be improved through neurostimulation. But as you correctly pointed out, it's in totally open question how long basically the modulatory effects of neurostimulation can last. So in prior research, it has been shown to improve reading and have symptoms relief that persist for up to a week. But of course, for these methods to be more impactful, we would aim for these effects to be more sustained, obviously.
What are the treatments right now? I know people as well who have dyslexia, and I'm aware of sort of behavioral therapy or tricks, tactics to get around it or to help you learn. Is it also being medicated right now?
It's entirely behavioral therapy up to this point.
So your work, the breakthrough, or the real potential breakthrough, is that this would lead to an actual medical intervention or a potential treatment or improvement for all the millions of people out there with dyslexia.
Exactly. So what we show here is, I think, showing a new target basically within the brain that is directly linked to reading difficulties in dyslexia, and targeting this area and modulate basically its activity might actually help these individuals in the future.
And for the people listening to this who possibly are suffering from dyslexia or know somebody who is, when could this be made available?
Yeah, that's a very good question. One that unfortunately I cannot answer or don't dare to give a guess, because I think, as I said, it's an emerging technique. It is increasingly being researched. But as I said, I mean, for a therapy to be fully effective, we would want these effects to to be sustainable, right? And this is like a key piece of knowledge that is still lacking at this point. Like, how do we need to set up these protocols of the neurostimulation to actually achieve long-lasting effects that basically make a difference in these people's lives at some point?
Krista, before Gabe and I came in here today, we were going back and forth on who we knew personally who with dyslexia, and we named a couple different names and then realized all of them were men or boys when we knew them. What are the numbers? Does that reflect reality, or is it just our specific anecdotes? Are men more affected by dyslexia than women?
Yes, yeah. So the evidence so far suggests that there is a 3-to-1 prevalence, actually. So males being affected 3 times as often as females. And yeah, I think that's why this also is one of the interesting aspects of our results, that we find that these specific brain changes in the visual thalamus really are linked to reading difficulties only in males with developmental dyslexia. So this might suggest that maybe different substrates at the level of the brain may be responsible for different symptoms in females and males with dyslexia, which maybe could partly explain also the prevalence difference between the sexes.
And that was Dr. Krista Müller-Axt talking to us there. She's the chair of cognitive and clinical neuroscience at the TUD Dresden University of Technology. Again, that publication or their research can be found in the journal Brain. Hmm.
I haven't thought about Dale in a long time. I just remember in my yearbook what he wrote in there. One of those years, he said, "May your summer be like toilet paper."
What?
Long and useful.
Like you said, smart. I mean, there's
what we never talked about during this entire interview is the social anxiety. I know for sure that Dale suffered because of the dyslexia. I know that for sure. It had an effect on him. And there have been studies on this about what it does to people. Not being able to read, it makes you so different than all the other kids. And there are so many people out there that could benefit in a huge way from any treatment.
But again, all of that aside, that's background. The great news here is we know this now. It may not necessarily be the whole puzzle figured out. It might be a part of it. She was talking about substructures that may affect the way that men compared to women, tend to process some of this visual information coming in. But at the very least, it's a very good start toward a potential therapy, and one that when we were talking to Krista, she didn't seem make it sound like it was all that complicated. Like, of course.
Very modest, humble, playing it down. Typical German researcher.
Really. Yeah.
Guys, anything to say on dyslexia, give it to us. SCBW.com.
DW, made for minds.